You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Stick Together. I'm Amy Ciara, my pronouns are she and her, and you're listening to the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, on the stolen land of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and we acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded. Today we have two reports. The first will be a reporting back on a Neighbourhood Housing Victoria campaign to secure more funding for them and their workers, and secondly we'll be looking at the strategic assessments for Melbourne and Geelong and how they may affect opportunities for employment for people working with plants. But first, some union news. On the 18th of February, Monash University's Safety Net Journal released its research report on examining pathways to secondary psychological injury, which was commissioned by WorkSafe Australia. Safety Net writes, "The term secondary psychological injury has a specific meaning in workers' compensation legislation. In some Australian jurisdictions, such as legislative definitions, typically indicate a diagnosed psychological condition with onset after a primary physical injury, reflecting a narrower interpretation than that developed in Monash SWA's project. The multiple compensation system, personal and workplace factors such as managers, actions, and attitudes, were identified as key drivers of secondary psychological injuries, with stakeholders and injured workers repeatedly highlighting that uncertainty regarding compensation claims process was a key contributor. Pre-injury mental health concerns and a loss of control over the financial and healthcare decisions when engaged in compensation processes where decision-making is undertaken by others, for example, insurers, also alleviates the risk of injured workers experiencing secondary psychological harm." The report went on to give 8 recommendations, which were 1. Adopt a national working definition of secondary psychological injury. 2. Develop more consistent approaches for risk screening at an individual level and monitoring at a portfolio level. 3. Reduce uncertainty for workers. 4. Minimize repetitive or unnecessary information gathering exercises or assessments. 5. Consider offering additional support throughout the claims process to assess workers with pre-injury mental health conditions and those with long-duration claims. 6. Explore the financial and economic impacts of secondary psychological injury and the impact that this has on return to work. 7. Develop a better understanding of the mental health symptoms experienced by workers and secondary psychological injury. 8. Conduct a detailed investigation of current interventions being offered in the sector and the evidence of their effectiveness. You can read the full article on the OHS website at www.ohsrep.org.au. On Tuesday, the 24th of February, the Albanese government announced another $230 million for further planning work for fast trains between Sydney and Newcastle for the eventual construction of the East Coast Bullet Train. Rail journeys on the new fast train could take as little as 1 hour between Sydney and Newcastle, and 30 minutes between Sydney and the Central Coast. The Transport and Infrastructure Minister, Catherine King, said rail journeys on the new fast train could take as little as 1 hour between Sydney and Newcastle, and 30 minutes between Sydney and the Central Coast. It takes more than 2.5 hours to travel by train from Sydney to Newcastle and almost 1.5 hours from Sydney to the Central Coast currently. Rail Trains and Buses Union National Secretary Alex Clarsons said the funding demonstrates a clear recognition that rail plays a clear role in Australia's future transport mix, going on to say, "For too long, our transport network has lacked the long-term investment and vision required to keep pace with the growing needs of Australians. High-speed rail represents a shift in direction away from reliance on the airline industry and private vehicles, with the potential to reshape how we move and our regions grow. The following two stories came from Sarah Misson's Stubsack, The Disputes Report. I highly recommend it for a weekly roundup of national union news. Down South Australia way, public sector nurses and midwives from the Australian Nurses and Midwives Federation at Lywell McEwen Hospital planned a 24 strike action for Thursday, the 19th of February. The South Australian government lodged a dispute in the South Australian Employment Tribunal seeking more time to prepare and to ensure, quote, patient safety. The strike was then postponed till the 26th of February. However, it was cancelled after an interim admission increase was offered. Nurses and midwives at Lyell McEwen Hospital will receive a 4% increase backdated to January 1st and an additional 2% from October 26, making that a total of 6%. Negotiations are now continuing for full wage claim and improved conditions while all industrial action is currently suspended. And the other disputes report item, the United Firefighters Union has initiated a rare enterprise order process in the WAIRC as the deadlock between the union and the state government refuses to budge. The United Firefighters Workers Union provided its log of claims to the government in February 2025 and rejected the first offer from the government in July and a second offer in November. The government rejected a counteroffer from the union in December. There have been over 20 bargaining meetings. Fireys are fighting for a 2% increase to their base rate, as well as a percentage wage increases and improvements to health and safety.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
On February the 18th, Neighbourhood Houses Victoria staff, volunteers and users of neighbourhood houses met at Victorian Parliament steps to demand the Victorian government increase their funding of neighbourhood houses by 25%, support 25 neighbourhood houses who did not currently receive any ongoing funding, and develop a fund for the establishment of 5 additional neighbourhood houses in Victoria's growth areas annually. Currently, workers are doing extra unpaid hours and volunteers are stretched. I attended the rally and recorded interviews and speeches with all the staff, volunteers and users of houses that were there to get that increase.
What neighbourhood house are you representing today?
So I'm Jo, I'm coordinator of Angus Neighbourhood House in Footscray.
Oh, amazing! Footscray, the centre of so much at the moment.
Absolutely. Heart of the inner west, I reckon.
Yeah. And why do the people of Footscray need your neighbourhood house?
Look, there are so many examples, but we are certainly an example in Footscray. I feel like the need for our neighbourhood house has never been greater. So many people need, you know, whether it's material assistance, whether it's social connection, whether it's, you know, assistance with other services and accessing things. Neighbourhood houses are such a conduit, such a broker, you know, for so many people to getting what they need and connecting with others and finding a sense of community. You know, it's really tricky times, I think, for many people. There's a lot of isolation, a lot of vulnerability, and what neighbourhood houses are amazing at is getting people together and not just doing that reactive, responsive stuff where you're sort of assisting with a real need, but actually proactively building the kind of community connection and strength that actually makes everyone safer, everyone, you know, more likely to find what they need, get what they need and stay safe and well. So we just can't believe that we have to do it on so little, you know, and yeah. We're amazing, like neighbourhood houses are incredible at doing what we do, but the reality is it's getting harder and harder to resource all the different things that we need. So yeah, hopefully big turnout today and we know we are well loved, but I think an understanding of just how hard it is on the resources that we currently have is needed. Yeah.
Get in there. I'd love lots of voices.
Add to that. I'm Catherine Curtin from the Louis Joel Arts and Community Centre in Altona.
Yeah.
You know what we do? We foster tolerance, and that's a big thing for not just Victoria, but Australian communities.
Yeah.
So the government should be investing in organisations that build tolerance amongst our community members.
Yeah. I actually go to a local LGBT plus group through my neighbourhood house.
Yay.
Yeah.
So, where is that at?
In Geelong.
Fabulous. Yeah. We do everything in neighbourhood houses.
Absolutely. And I get to connect. Yeah.
Community.
Yeah.
Is where people need to be, you know, like what we need to be fostering, like Catherine said, sense of belonging, community, being part of, not fractured. And neighbourhood houses are key pieces of infrastructure that in our communities that actually enable that. They're the very one of the very few that bring so many different streams of community together. And that's what we need to be investing in.
And it's I learned from Kia, the CEO, that the origins of neighbourhood houses were just women getting together to build them, to just put some funds together, buy a house and look after their community.
Well, yeah, I mean, they came out of the women's movement, neighbourhood houses. So they came already out of a social activist space to provide spaces and places for women, by women. And then they... then from that grassroots then expanded out into broader community. So they come from a from an activist belonging place, and that's what's really important to honor and remember that this was started organically by women.
Thanks for that. Good luck today.
Look, I love all neighbourhood houses because they're just so different and they have an amazing ability to just meet the needs of the communities in which they're situated. So whatever the gaps are in that community, is that's what the neighbourhood houses work with communities to bring, that real strength-based approach to community development.
And are you representing a particular neighbourhood house today?
Yeah, I'm here with the Mallee Neighbourhood House Network. So we've come from Mildura, Robinvale, Murraville, Oyen, Bullock Shire, like Gunawarra Shire. It's amazing.
And what are some of the fun activities that happened at your place?
So at our neighbourhood houses, we could do craft activities, exercise, a lot of social inclusion, which is really important. We help link people into other services as well, so which is a real challenge, I suppose, particularly in rural and isolated areas where there's not the other services there.
I was just saying that I go to a neighbourhood house in Geelong, and our LGBT plus community group meets there, and we get community connection in a town where maybe it's a little bit harder to find that.
Absolutely, and that's what I love about the neighbourhood houses, that they really have this niche ability to be able to make sure that everyone is included and everyone has a place.
I would like to tell you about why I'm here today. And it's because I strongly believe about the critical role that community houses have in our community, but it's more than ever, more than ever, what they do in relation to social connection, in relation to opportunities for, you know, future employments, information and referral. So that's why I am. And when I started, this is my personal, you know, part of it. When I came to Australia in 1975, one of the first things I did, you know, probably after 2 years, it was a little course that it was actually provided by Homer's Glen Community House. I'm not sure about the name, where they actually were, learned how to be in this country, to adapt to this country, to all of those things. So that's why, personally, it's very important.
Neighbourhood houses has... Geraldina, one of our committee members, said it's very important because that's a place that that the community feels safe to come in and ask for any sort of help, and especially for new migrants, where our Springvale neighbourhood house is situated. We get new migrants, refugees, they don't know where to go, and they find this place very comfortable to come to and get help from. So it's very important that neighbourhood houses and community centres are important in the community.
Can I hear about why you love your neighbourhood house?
Why I love it? Because I work there. No, it's a good community place. It's a place to get people involved, and it's a place for people to come and place to people for people to be informed. It's part of connecting everyone.
And is there a special value it has because it's in a rural community?
Possibly, because we're the only one in that rural community. So, but it's valuable for the people that choose to use it.
And which neighbourhood house is this?
Hamilton.
Great.
Right in the Western District.
Okay,
The Windy West.
Did you want to say something as well?
Sure. Hi, I'm Emily from the Camperdown Community House. I'm a part of the Southwest Neighbourhood House Network with Deb. And I think neighbourhood houses, especially in rural areas, are in a unique position to be able to respond in real time to emerging community need in a unique way compared to other agencies that might be restrained by the funding and the specific sort of nature of how they're supposed to operate. So the community development component is really important to maintain, I think.
Do people come to escape the heat?
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
So would you need...
They also come to stay warm in winter.
So would longer hours help for them?
Yes, absolutely.
As long as you're paid?
There's a lot of unpaid hours. And I think our sector really relies a lot on our volunteer workforce. So there's and goodwill, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Very pleased now to hand over to our president, Beth Davidson, OAM. Beth, many of you know she's a long history in this sector. I won't try and summarise it. I will hand over to you, Beth, firstly to say a few words.
Thank you very much, Kia. And as Kia did, I would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners upon whose land we meet today, but whose lands we come from far and wide as well. Kia has already said how far and wide you've all come. And of course, the thing that really strikes me about our sector is volunteers. You've come this far at your own personal expense, not first, so well done. And you've come to deliver a really important message to our elected representatives. Keep our doors open. Now, neighbourhood houses, like most organisations, we continue to face rising costs. Yet, we face the additional impacts of increased community need and the erosion of core funding. Our sector came into being across Victoria when the government was actually to meet the government's desire to establish a web of community development communities at the local level. And volunteers strived to respond by leveraging the small neighbourhood house coordination program investment that currently sits at $43 million a year. How much do hospitals get? $43 million a year, and we deliver a measurable community value of $922 million. What else gives you that kind of cost-benefit ratio? And that's money that we save the state government by improving wellbeing, reducing isolation, connecting people to services, helping communities develop and thrive. We've delivered on the original aspiration of the NHCP, the Neighbourhood House Coordination Program. We've delivered beyond your wildest dreams. We are at the very coalface of service social cohesion. We walk our talk, we drive dollars hard, and we demonstrate that we can deliver. However, sadly, due to inadequate indexation over many years, the program that was designed to cover only part-time wages and operational costs has been eroded to such a degree that now it no longer meets even the needs of the part-time staff members, with nothing left to keep our lights on and our doors open. Some neighbourhood houses are even at risk of closure, even with significant volunteer input, because that's what we've got to remember. There is significant volunteer input into this small current investment that is made. And others, houses have had to take steps to cut hours and services. In fact, operational hours in the sector are now at the lowest point in 10 years. And the loss of value to communities for that, we calculated since 2024, is $233 million community benefit lost. And additionally, here we have currently 25 neighbourhood houses.
Woman, take up and You're listening to Stick Together, Worker Stories and Union News, broadcast around the country every week on the Community Radio Network.
The final report for today is following on from my previous contribution to Stick Together, following the trades that work in maintaining, building, conserving, and restoring our green spaces. The Australian Government's Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment, and Water is soon to finalise with the City of Greater Geelong the Geelong Strategic Assessment. Geelong is one of the fastest growing regional cities in Victoria, which is undergoing rapid urban development. The Geelong Strategic Assessment follows the model of the Melbourne Strategic Assessment that designates areas in urban environments and new builds for protecting Indigenous flora and fauna, as well as sacred sites to First Nations people. The corporation managing the Geelong Strategic Assessment is Biosis of the APEM Group. APEM Group owns a whole range of businesses in the business of renewable energy infrastructure, biosecurity and ecology surveys, and so on. They are partnering with Open Lines, who do environmental consultancy work and have largely worked on government infrastructure projects, and with BHB Billiton, that famously eco-conscious organisation. On the Biosis webpage for the Geelong Strategic Assessment, they say, Geelong has and will continue to experience rapid urban development. The northern and western Geelong growth areas will be home to 110,000 residents and forms a key part of the council strategy to meet its long-term housing needs. The City of Greater Geelong is collaborating with the Australian Government to prepare a strategic assessment under Part 10 of the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act of 1999 for the northern and western Geelong growth areas. This allows for a strategic approach to safeguarding matters of national environmental significance from the impacts of development in the long term. While the use of strategic assessments can deliver benefits for developers and regulators through regulatory efficiency and for the environment through upfront strategic planning, the approval pathway is not straightforward and the process can be lengthy. End of quote. The strategic assessment will seek protection of certain threatened species, including the grassland earless dragon and the growling grass frog. What is not mentioned are the significant Indigenous artifact that belonged to the Wadawurrung people mentioned in their draft assessment report in 2023. However, to be fair, what is on their website isn't as detailed as that older report. But the issues I am mostly concerned with is how much of the remaining vestiges of native vegetation, habitats and Wadawurrung artifacts will be left, and how will the City of Greater Geelong go about implementing the plan to ensure that quality work will be done on these precious sites. 3 years after the Melbourne Strategic Assessment was implemented, an article surfaced in April 2023 in the Journal of Ecological Management and Restoration called Evaluating the Melbourne Strategic Assessment, Elegant on Process, Currently Failing on Implementations by Kim Lowe and Jeffrey Westcott. In the article, they call the protection of the biodiversity and environmental outcomes a failure. The MSA and the GSA are both complicated and shrouded in complicated legislation, but the real test is, do they sufficiently protect threatened species and ecosystems? But who are they? They are the councils managing the budgets, paying the various, often multiple different contractors on a bidding system which can lead to varying levels of qualified and skilled workers. Let's go back to Lowe and Westcott. The Melbourne Strategic Assessment was initiated at an opportune time. The alignment of strategic planning for supply of housing, land and transport provided a mechanism and an authorising environment to integrate these with biodiversity considerations. However, this integration is not mandated under the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act of 1999. End quote. So what does that mean? Well, it means that it requires goodwill on all the parties implementing it to make sure it works and that the biodiversity and environmental outcomes are met. So, do we think the Greater Geelong City Council has goodwill towards the environment and Indigenous sites? The current leadership of the council has close ties to major property developers in the region. So, they also support the federal government's bipartisan support to build Town of Geelong into a major weapons manufacturing hub through the Geelong Defence Alliance, which is investing hundreds of millions of dollars into developing defence manufacturing in the local region. Only 3 of Geelong's 11 councillors have demonstrably shown up for climate action and First Nations justice. In fact, Geelong City Council is one of the councils to return celebrations of so-called Australia Day. As Sue Bull from Green Left write, in May 2023, City of Geelong had decided to stop referring to January 26 as Australia Day, rescheduling citizenship ceremonies to within 3 days of that date and to commit to the Uluru Statement of the Heart. This came after an extensive community consultation with First Nations communities, and only 32% of the broader community opposed the change. These decisions were all then overturned, with 100 people only allowed to attend the meeting, was enforced by police and security. Mayor Stretch Contels refused to answer questions in public question and submission time, including from local First Nations leaders such as Auntie Wendy Brabham, Julie Saylor Briggs, and Jordan Edwards, several of which were about January 26. Councillor Eddie Contelge, the brother of the Mayor Stretch, then moved a motion to fully reinstitute Australia Day celebrations on January 26, 2025. One First Nations attendee shouted, "What are you celebrating? I'm telling you about the pain it's causing me as an Aboriginal man." That's the Green Left article. To add to this, registered Aboriginal party, the Wadawurrung Traditional Owners Aboriginal Corporation, have continuously expressed concern over Geelong's rapid urban sprawl and its destruction to country and environment. Wadawurrung currently employs local First Nations people in management of country and biodiversity across Wadawurrung region. Former CEO of the registered Aboriginal party, Auntie Karina Eccles, is also a board member of Barwon Water and has worked to bring cultural knowledge, perspective and values relating to water and community. This can be seen across the new housing developments in Geelong, with many public parks incorporating endemic ecologies, water systems, and education about local First Nations history and culture. So, it is in my personal view that these strategic assessments, which are also promoted to be a national model, by the way, what they really are is just another environmental and sensitive sites ticker box exercise, while the real focus is on big spending for housing and infrastructure. The environmental laws and protections for sacred sites are weak enough to just bypass these assessments anyway. But the reality of the climate crisis is that human beings, particularly here in the global minority, need to rein it in on endless growth on a finite planet. There are enough houses and buildings to be made fit for purpose to house everyone. We need to be investing in jobs and workers who can restore the environment and rapidly store carbon where it belongs in the ground. So if you're a worker in these important and undervalued industries, it's time to organise and get active.
You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news and social justice issues.
That's it for Stick Together this week. If you want to catch up with our program, the podcast is available at 3cr.org.au or at your favourite podcast site. You can contact the producers of the show at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or by ringing 03-9419-8377 and leave us a message. My name's Amy Ciara. Remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there is a union for you. And until next time, stick together.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.